From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. President Trump has delivered in a big way on his campaign promise to undo and weaken environmental regulations and protections. To date, the Trump administration has rolled back or attempted to roll back at least 100 environmental rules and regulations, that according to a recent New York Times analysis. And the effort continues through the pandemic, alarming, among others, climate scientists who warn that every moment counts as our planet continues to experience the effects of climate change. This hour on Point, environmental rollbacks and how they affect the world and its most vulnerable communities. Joining us from New York City is Kendra Pierre Lewis, reporter for Gimlet Media, a narrative podcasting company. Previously, she was a climate reporter for the New York Times. She's author of the 2012 book Greenwashed: Why We Can't Buy Our Way to a Green Planet. Her writing has also appeared in Popular Science, The Washington Post, Newsweek, 538, and others. Kendra, great to have you. Thanks for joining us and helping us understand this important event, these important issues.
Thank you so much for having me, Anthony.
So, Kendra, can you sort of walk us through sort of some of these rollbacks? Let's start with efforts to weaken Obama-era fuel economy and greenhouse gas standards for passenger cars and light trucks. Can we start there and give us a sense of what's happened?
Sure. So basically, under the Obama administration, they wanted to increase the fuel efficiency of automobiles. This is great for consumers because you can get more miles per gallon. It's also great for fighting against climate change because the less gasoline you burn, the fewer emissions you emit. President Trump's administration made a decision to roll back those standards to such a degree. It was kind of an interesting tension because auto manufacturers actually didn't really want that. At the same time, there was a weird loophole in the law which allowed California to set its own regulations, and the Trump administration also attacked sort of that loophole. And the net effect is that their cars in the future will be less fuel efficient, but also will emit more greenhouse gas emissions.
So automakers did not want the rollback. What was the rationale for pushing that forward coming from the Trump administration?
So automakers did not want the rollbacks, but oil companies did. So you have to understand the position that auto companies are in, which is they're making cars for a global market. And so it's much easier for auto companies to have a consistent sort of regulatory framework that they're operating within, as opposed to a bunch of different standards all over the world, right? And the Obama regulations are kind of more in line with what's going on globally. And so now they're in this unusual situation where they're sort of working through this checkerboard pattern, and it makes it more difficult for them. Versus the oil company, which have an entrenched interest in us consuming oil.
Right.
So they don't have, that's like one case where those interests weren't aligned.
So, Kendra, I want to move on to another. The Trump administration has replaced the Obama-era Clean Power Plan, right, which would have set strict limits on carbon emissions and coal and gas-fired plants with a new version. So tell us about that and the effects of that.
Yeah, so the net effect is that we're going to have more air pollution and we're going to have more carbon emissions. So in the short term, anyway, so the argument for this one is that coal-fired plants are suffering and that the regulations are burdensome. But the reality is, at least in the United States, there's still this underlying tension with natural gas. Like, the reason coal companies have been struggling so much in this country is not so much because of regulations. And a lot of coal companies will tell you that themselves. It's because of the competition from natural gas. Natural gas is just so much cheaper to operate.
Okay, so there's that. Canceled requirements for oil and gas companies to report methane emissions. By the way, I'm reading this list from a great sort of roundup from the New York Times recently, which did an analysis we mentioned in the introduction of 100 rollbacks or efforts to roll back. But what's that referring to?
Yeah, so when you drill for oil, you sometimes go through kind of like a natural gas layer, and that releases methane into the atmosphere. Ideally, what you would do is you would burn it, there are two options. You would capture it and you would sell it off as fuel, but oftentimes it's too costly, especially right now because natural gas is so cheap, or you would burn it. And it sounds weird to be saying that, like, I'm advocating that you burn a fuel, but methane is one of the most potent greenhouse gas emissions in the world. And so it's actually better for the environment to burn it. It's called a process called flaring, then allow it to emit straight into the atmosphere. And so one of the things that has happened over recent times is we've known that our methane emissions have gone up, and the source of those methane emissions strongly linked to drilling for natural gas and oil. And so what we want is what the Obama era said was, we need to know how much is sort of coming out of there and we need you to track it. And what the Trump administration is saying, don't really worry about that.
Okay, here's another one. Revoked a rule that prevented coal companies from dumping mining debris into local streams. What would be the rationale for that?
It's expensive to not dump it into a stream, is my best guess. Mm-hmm. So some of these, it's not necessarily clear what the rationale is, but my best guess is that in that it's called like overburden. In that case, it is very difficult. Like, I don't know, you know, it is generally speaking much easier to dispose of something. It's much cheaper to dispose of something somewhat carelessly. You know, like you can take, it takes more effort for you to take a piece of, I don't know, a potato chip bag and like find a garbage can when you're walking in the street and put it in a can, right? It's much easier to just crumple it up and drop it on the floor, right? It's kind of the same thing with oftentimes coal plants are located near waterways. So it's a very easy thing for them just to, not necessarily even deliberately, but like not have that concern of whether or not it impacts a waterway.
Mm. Let me ask you about efforts on proposed bans of pesticides linked to developmental disabilities in children. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so it is a very potent pesticide. And so a lot of states are beginning to enact their own bans since the federal one was overturned. And this matters because we often don't think of the fact that farms are located in communities, but they are. And there are cases, especially like in California, for example, where a field of like strawberries might be pressed up against a schoolyard. So it's, so like there's pretty close proximity to the people who are spraying in the field and to like children in many cases.
And we're talking here specifically about a pesticide linked to developmental disabilities in children known as, and I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong, chlorpyrifos. Is that, am I doing that right?
I think you're doing a better job than I am, which is why I avoided saying it, because it's a mouthful. But yes, that pesticide in particular, it's been banned in some countries, and there are lots of proposed bans across the United States at this point since the federal rule was overturned.
Okay, here's another rollback. Change the way the Endangered Species Act is applied, making it more difficult to protect wildlife from long-term threats posed by climate change. What are we talking about there?
Yeah, so one of the things that there, look, like there used to be sort of more of an ecosystem approach to when you think about whether or not a species was endangered, and they're sort of saying the ecosystem kind of doesn't matter as much. It's just kind of a pure count question. And so obviously that doesn't, we know that animals are dependent on ecosystems, and oftentimes, especially with animals that are somewhat migratory, you can't just protect sort of like their nesting grounds. You have to kind of think through the full ways in which the animal sort of occupies a space or occupies a territory.
Hmm. One more. Ended an Obama-era rule that barred using bait to lure and kill grizzly bears, among other sport hunting practices that many people consider extreme, on some public lands in Alaska.
Yeah, I feel like that one is pretty self-explanatory. So, like, there are cases in Alaska, for example, of people, like, baiting bears with donuts and things to sort of bring them out and attract them with food. And so from a hunter, I guess if you're a hunter perspective, the ability to bait makes things better or easier for you. But the downside of baiting bears with food in particular, and bears are like my favorite animal, is that you accustom them to people, human food. And so they become more likely to seek out human sources of food.
All right. Well, there's a partial list anyway of what's happened over the last 3 years in terms of environmental regulations and protections under the Trump administration. I'm with Kendra Pierre-Lewis. She's a reporter for Gimlet Media, a narrative podcasting company, and she's a great expert on these issues. She's tracked them for a long time. Kendra, how has this continued during the pandemic? Has it continued during the pandemic?
Yes, it has continued during the pandemic, and it's kind of continued in two ways. There's sort of the So when we published that piece, it was mid-May, and some of those rollbacks were in process, right? So now some of those rollbacks have been finalized, and they're continuing the process of completing that. They're continuing to complete the process for finalizing some of these rules. So there's that kind of bucket of things. The other way, and we often don't think about this, but rules have two components. You can make the rule, but if you don't enforce the rule, it's almost like the rule doesn't exist, right? Mm-hmm. And so on the other side, the Trump administration has also been pretty lax on enforcement, and they've been lax on enforcement since prior to COVID. I think enforcement fell 50% over the time that they took office. But since COVID, they've gone kind of on the record with saying things like, they're not going to expect compliance with the routine monitoring and reporting of pollution, and won't pursue penalties for polluters that are breaking the rules, basically. And they're continuing to use this time to, as I mentioned earlier, to push back on some of these rolling back regulations. And there's one in particular, which is like the Pebble Mine, where they're supposed to have tribal input. There have been changes to the proposal, and the tribes themselves are basically, at least one of the tribes is saying, like, hey, we're supposed to have input, but we're kind of busy dealing with COVID right now. Like, can we slow this down? Or they've been doing some meetings over Zoom. But generally, enforcement has been down a lot. And that matters because, like, when you look at what we're talking about, pollution, in many cases, we're talking about things like air pollution, right? I mean, now with COVID-19, air pollution is a factor for death. Like, you're more likely to die if you've had sort of persistent exposure to air pollution over your lifetime, or you live in a heavily air polluted area and get COVID. And so at the same time, the administration was saying that they are not going to push forward. They're not going to kind of hold polluters accountable. They're not going to make sure that they're not polluting during this time where it's a public health crisis. Other parts of the administration have been making decisions to say, hold back on prescribed burns of wildfire because they know that that smoke is harmful to people.
We are talking about the rollback of environmental rules and regulations over the last 3 years by the Trump administration. I'm joined by Kendra Pierre-Lewis. And Kendra, stand by, because when I come back, I want to talk about some of the legal challenges by states, environmental groups, and others, and to what extent these challenges have been successful. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the rollback of environmental rules and regulations under the Trump administration and what they mean for our most vulnerable communities, especially during a global pandemic. We're joined this hour from New York City by Kendra Pierre-Lewis. She's a reporter for Gimlet Media. She's covered climate, the environment, and science for the New York Times, Popular Science, and many others. And by the way, you can link to an excellent piece co-reported by Kendra in the New York Times. The Trump administration is reversing 100 environmental rules. Here's the full list. That's at onpointradio.org. Kendra, before I follow up with one more question to you, I want to just read a response from the EPA. We did invite a representative of the Environmental Protection Agency to join this program. Here's what we got back from them, a statement. Due to a recent experience with Montana Public Radio that failed to include a potential conflict of interest with another interviewee, and in which a reporter described her interview with Administrator Wheeler as unsettling, we will not be able to participate. So that came from James Hewitt, EPA Associate Administrator for Public Affairs. We want to point out that On Point is an NPR program produced by WBUR in Boston. We have no connection with Montana Public Radio. We're not sure what that flap with Montana Public Radio was about. But that's what we got from the EPA. So no one from the EPA is with us this hour, and we regret that. Kendra, I want to just ask you, in terms of the legal challenges to many of these rollbacks from states, from environmental groups and others, to what extent have these challenges been successful or are ongoing?
Yeah, so there are kind of two flavors of legal challenges. The first was when the administration first began doing the rollback, they didn't sort of follow the process by which you have to do to undo a regulation. And so those challenges were kind of immediately upheld because, you didn't follow the rules. And they since sort of went back to the drawing board and followed the process by which they have to undo those rules. And some of them have been successfully undone, and those rules have to be considered finalized until another administration takes over, whether that's in 4 years or in or in a year. I forgot what year it is, COVID time.
happening to all of us, Kendra. You're in good company.
The other flavor kind of legal challenges, which are still winding their way through the court, is that some of the regulations that they've rolled back were put in place because of lawsuits that said that the federal government had to regulate these things in the first place. And so those challenges are saying that the Clean Power Plan is a good example. Those challenges are essentially saying that the regulations the Trump administration has put in place to replace the Clean Power Plan doesn't go far enough. It does not meet the standards set forth by the legal challenges that sort of created the need for the Clean Power Plan in the first place.
I see.
And those are still working their way through the courts.
Kendra, stand by because I want to introduce Gina McCarthy. She joins us from Boston. She's president and CEO of the Natural Resources Defense Council. From 2013 to 2017, she served as administrator of the EPA under the Obama administration. She's also chair of the board of advisors at the Harvard Center for Climate, Health, and Global Environment. And former administrator McCarthy, it's great to have you on Point. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. It's great to be here. Hi, Kendra.
Hi, Gina.
So I'd like to start with you, Gina McCarthy, and just talk about how difficult it was in the first place to get some of these policies and regulations in place. Give us an insider's view of that effort, of those efforts.
Well, I'll be happy to. You know, regulations are not easy to do. They're not supposed to be, because government is only supposed to regulate in a way that is protective of health and the natural resources that otherwise couldn't be handled or isn't being handled by the marketplace itself. So it's tough to do these rules. It takes many years to do the science that underpins it. Then when you do the rule, you have to look at all of the consequences of that rule, both costs and benefits, whether they're directly related to the rule or indirectly related to that rule. And so you have to do a wealth of information gathering, analysis, modeling, and where climate is concerned, where many of these rules actually impact in a good way. We had to look at, obviously, the challenges associated with climate change, which can impact in particular our Clean Air Act rules. And we had to make the case that they were beneficial and cost effective. And so it's not an easy thing to do these rules. It takes huge public input. For example, on the Clean Power Plan, we had more than 8 million comments on that rule, and you have to answer them in order for it to be legally solid in terms of the case you're making. And so it takes a lot of work to get this done. And the Obama administration really in the first 4 years focused very heavily, as we all know, on the Affordable Care Act, but also tried to push forward and support a legislative initiative to address climate change. But that initiative failed by 2 Senate votes. Mm-hmm. It passed in the House. And what happened then was that the focus of attention shifted to EPA, especially during my purview over EPA, to look at the Clean Air Act, because we knew that carbon pollution had been decided by the Supreme Court in an earlier legal case to be a pollutant as defined under the Clean Air Act. And if we could show that particular sectors of the economy actually emitted enough pollution to be a problem for health or our environment, then we had the authority and, in fact, the responsibility to regulate it. So many of the rules that Kendra mentioned, for example, the car rules or the clean power rules. One of the other rules that wasn't mentioned she did mention the methane rules. All of those were done under the Clean Air Act with the understanding that carbon pollution that fuels climate change has many damages to health and our environment, not just the planet, but to individuals in terms of their health, and our understanding that the majority of those impacts actually hit the communities that have been left behind,
and
those
I wanna,
most vulnerable.
Yeah, the most vulnerable communities. I want to get to that point because that's such an important one. Gina McCarthy, I want to ask you one more question before we move on to that. We talked about how difficult it is to get some of these policies and regulations in place, how it takes a long time. So once they're undone, let's imagine at some point in the future when there might be a different administration in power, it's not just like sort of flipping a switch and saying, okay, we want to bring those regulations back, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And I think Kendra's right. There's tremendous weaknesses in the way in which this administration has attempted to do all of these rollbacks. But the damage is that they have fundamentally tried to undermine science, and there are many scientists that have left federal service because they have been pigeonholed and harassed, and there's information that's not getting to the public. And there are a variety of rules that now are in limbo. And so I want your listeners to understand that these rules, many of them, in fact, most, I would argue, are likely to be reversed, but it means we're in limbo. We're losing opportunities. For example, NRDC itself has sued the federal government 115 times because of decisions that this administration has made. And we have a 90% success rate. But that's hardly fulfilling when you know that the rules we had in place, for example, the car rules, would have reduced 455 million metric tons of CO2. And instead, now the Trump administration has acknowledged they're releasing 867 more million metric tons of CO2 with this rollback. And they're also costing our consumers, because the Obama rule would have saved drivers $86 billion. And instead, we're talking about losing $22 billion and loss of 10 to 20,000 jobs. So this has ramifications not just for our health and our natural resources, but it has ramifications on how we grow the economy. And clean energy is it, baby, whether this administration wants to recognize it or not. And we have opportunities here to grow that clean energy economy. And instead, they're just feeding the beast of the fossil fuel companies. They're just providing lots of bennies to the oil and gas sector that they don't deserve and we cannot afford from a health or a natural resource or an economic perspective.
I want to bring in Dr. Georges Benjamin, Executive Director of the American Public Health Association. From 1999 to 2002, he served as Secretary of the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene and as Deputy Secretary for Public Health Services in Maryland from 1995 to 1999. And Dr. Benjamin, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So I know you've been listening along to this conversation so far, and I want to ask you specifically, when we talk about how the rollback of environmental regulations and protections that we've been talking about, how this has a disproportionate impact on low income and communities predominantly made up of people of color. What do we see there? What is your concern?
You know, the fact is that those communities are less likely to create the degree of pollution, but are much more exposed to air pollution, primarily because of where those communities are located. For example, we know that inner city communities are about 9 degrees hotter than many of our white communities in the urban setting. That's because they have less green space, you know, less trees, more dark surfaces. They also have a higher prevalence of chronic diseases, you know, heart disease, asthma, diabetes, lung disease, which makes them at a disproportionate risk of getting sicker or dying sooner should they be exposed more to the air pollution.
Right. I'm looking at a recent study from Harvard that found that an increase in air pollution leads to large increases in the COVID-19 death rates. So you have to believe, based on what you said, that this would affect these vulnerable communities disproportionately, right?
No question about that. More birth defects, more heart attacks, more asthma attacks. And we know this to be true, that this has been demonstrated many, many, many times. And then when you think about what happens when you get a pandemic like COVID that enters the community, where these communities are already physiologically more vulnerable and more exposed, they're going to get sicker and die sooner.
Let's go to a couple of our listeners. Rachel is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Rachel, thanks for joining the conversation. You're on the air.
Hi, y'all. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I've noticed here in the Madison area that even despite having very, very mild asthma my entire life, I've had to take my inhaler many, many times, and it just angers me that the president is ignoring this crisis when we can see the day-to-day effects of people, especially younger people who don't know exactly what's going on. So just seeing myself having to take my inhaler much more often, just like the doctor said earlier.
Understand. Rachel, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Alec, who's calling from Greenwood, Maine. Alec, you're on the air. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Hi there. I live and work on the Androscoggin River, which was essentially unusable before the Clean Water Act of 1972. People would say that the houses on the side of the river would turn black from the chemical fumes coming off of it. There were rumors of three-eyed fish, and you could absolutely not swim in it. The Clean Water Act of 1972 basically saved the river. Nowadays, I work driving shuttles, putting people on the river. They fish, they swim, they enjoy the scenery, even catching a buck trout. And I know the Trump administration is looking to roll back and dismantle the Clean Water Act, and it's just beyond me as to why he would want to do such a thing. It's my livelihood. It's the place that I love, and I cannot wrap my head around it.
All right, Alec, thanks for that call. Gina McCarthy, I want to get you to sort of respond and amplify what what Georges Benjamin was talking about in terms of these issues having a particular impact on vulnerable communities. You began to set that idea up before I introduced him, but add to that.
You know, one of the interesting things is that during COVID-19, you mentioned the Harvard study, but also there was an American Medical Association study that showed that pregnant women exposed to high temperatures or air pollution are more likely to have children who are premature, underweight, and stillborn. We have known these issues for a really long time. You know, EPA is not a birds and bunnies agency. I'm sorry, I don't mean that negatively. We love birds and bunnies. We're a people agency. So we clean up the air because we know it directly relates to people's health. We produce clean water because we need clean water to drink and be healthy. So we have known for years that there are communities left behind. So I'm glad people are finally being awakened to that issue. But if you think anyone thinks that systemic racism and disinvestment in Black communities and low-income community is not related directly to your health, you're wrong. And so we have to connect the dots today between what's happening with COVID-19 and who's dying at greater rates than anybody else, which is the Black community. We have to look at asthma rates, which run 10 times higher than Caucasians when you look at the Latino community. We have to look at who's left behind. And one of the reasons why you fundamentally do health protections is to level the playing field here. So much of what we were doing with the Clean Power Plan was recognizing that we're not protecting the planet. We're protecting people's health. We estimated thousands of people would be better protected because as you take action on climate, you reduce conventional pollutants. And we know that with climate change and excess heat, you are talking about multitudes of death as a result of those increased heat that you see, particularly in vulnerable communities, because it raises the amount of haze, the amount of pollution that's in the air. It makes our kids more vulnerable. And part of the really upsetting part of this administration is much of the actions that they have taken, like the not banning chlorpyrifos, like not moving forward to maintain our mercury and air toxic standard, and looking at the clean water rule is and abandoning that is actually exposing our children to more levels of toxics that we know diminish their mental capability, that make them sick and make them die at large at higher levels. It's just unconscionable how they are forgetting the role of government to actually protect people.
Administrator Gina McCarthy, we're going to come back in a moment. We're going to take a short break. Listeners, we're talking about environmental rollbacks under the Trump administration and how they affect the most vulnerable Americans. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about the future of the Republican Party. Longtime Republican voters, we want you to give us your ideas for the GOP for election 2020 and beyond. How can the party lead effectively and grow? What could or should the GOP do to appeal to younger voters as well as to black and brown voters? Leave us a voicemail with your advice for Republican leadership at 617-353-0683. Again, that's 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about rollbacks of environmental rules under the Trump administration. And with me is Kendra Pierre-Lewis, reporter for Gimlet Media and author of Greenwashed, Why We Can't Buy Our Way Out to a Green Planet. Gina McCarthy, president and CEO of the Natural Resources Defense Council and former administrator of the EPA. And Dr. Georges Benjamin, executive director for the American Public Health Association. And Dr. Benjamin, I want to pick up with you on a point that Gina McCarthy made before the break, and really this important link between health effects that we're seeing from the rollback of these environmental protections and how it really is linked to this idea around systemic racism, which is so much at the fore these days. And in a way, the pandemic has really ripped the cover essentially off this issue and brought it to the fore. So I'd love to get your thoughts on it.
Well, I think it's important that the nation begin to step back and look at all of our policies, procedures, regulations, and understand what the disparate impact they have on various communities. So when you have a policy like this where you begin to roll back regulations, which are frankly designed to protect all of us, when you do that, though, they have a disparate impact on communities that are underserved, that are have been less supported over the years. So these policies in their very basis originally were designed to protect everybody, but also by their very design were also designed to address some of the structural racism that we have in our system. So when you roll them back, all you're doing is reverting back to the way they were before, and you're putting more people at risk. And I remind folks that while there's a disparity for communities of color, everybody gets sick when you roll back these regulations.
Mm. Kendra, I'd like to get you in on this as well. Dr. Benjamin's point that obviously these regulations are in place to protect everybody, right?
Yeah, he's right. He's right that communities of color, especially Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities, are disproportionately impacted when these rules get rolled back. But there's a ton of literature that is found that when a community is more segregated, when they're less integrated, that the overall levels of pollution are higher. So environmental racism hurts everyone.
Right. Gina McCarthy, can these rollbacks be rolled back? I mean, how do you think about that? And how long is this going to take? Or just give me your thoughts on that as someone who has been on the inside and been so responsible for some of these regulations to begin with.
Look, you know, one thing that I have found is that health matters to people. And I think Dr. Benjamin, who is a terrific colleague, knows this well. You know, if we make our case, we are going to roll these back. I don't have any question about that. The question is when. And the question is, how quickly can we make up for lost time? And so I have every confidence that these are legally flawed. They don't follow the science. They haven't followed appropriate procedures. And when we reverse them and we put something in place, it's not going to be what we did 8 years ago. It's going to be where we are today and what the science tells us. So I have every expectation that while I'm really ticked off that all these rules have been revisited in a way that's more expensive and loses lives and loses good jobs, because it makes no sense. I have every confidence that we will beat them back. They will be more stringent because we're going to look at the science of today. And I think we're going to show that that we can paint a picture of the future that is better, not just for all of us, but much better for vulnerable communities that have been left behind. So while we're sitting here bemoaning things, and I love to do that, I want you all to know that I am extraordinarily hopeful. You know, you had that gentleman calling in from Maine talking about how great things have progressed. Well, I lived through the era of the 70s and 80s. I remember the first Earth Day. We have made huge progress, and there is no way on this earth that we should think that we have the luxury of bemoaning as much as running as fast as we can when a new administration is in place. And it seems pretty clear to me that people are unhappy about being locked in their homes and being unsuccessful at throughout the country at protecting our population from COVID-19. While some of us are locked in, others of us are hanging out in bars. It doesn't work that way. They're unhappy with the economy as it sits right now. If we can get a stimulus dollars moving, we just had a great basically unveiling of a plan by the Select Committee on the Climate Crisis that showed that with existing solutions today, we can get at 88% of the reductions we need by 2050. We can get to clean cars by 2035. No emissions whatsoever. We have solutions at our fingertips. So I expect that this will be a dam that breaks as soon as this administration leaves, which I make no mistake about it, I hope is in November. And then we'll move forward, we'll get these rules back in place, and we'll do more, and we'll expand the solutions that really lead to a better future. This stimulus better invest in clean energy. It better not try to move us backwards, because that's yesterday's problem, not the future for my kids and my grandchildren.
All right, let's go to another caller. Enrique is calling from Miami. Enrique, good to have you on. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
A pleasure to be on your show. Love your show. Well, where to start? We have a president, and one of his very first moves to empower and try to promote coal energy and his employees, I think it's just from there we just went downhill. And I can tell you that being in Miami, which is a water level and low line, we're seeing the high tides coming higher and greater every single month. We have several areas in the city that get underwater, under salt water, for 10 days, 15 days every single month now. On top of that, we have most of the cities now in the county have voted not to recycle anymore because it's too expensive for them. So we don't even recycle in most of the cities.
Enrique, I'm going to take it back from you, because the point that I want to sort of follow up on is your point about essentially the effects of climate change and the impact that that's having on low-lying cities like Miami. Kendra, carbon emissions, of course, linked to extreme weather. You know, as you look ahead, how are we doing in this regard?
I mean, we're in hurricane season, and we had our first, our first named storm before the official start of hurricane season. Like, look, we know, Gina kind of hinted at this. We know that there's a certain amount of emissions that are locked into the system, that we are already experiencing the effects of climate change, and that we are going to have to adapt to what we've already emitted. But the flip side of that is, how bad can it get? And that is a choice that is ultimately determined by what we do now. And so every day that we delay in climate action, we are committing ourselves to a future that is worse off, because we are, every unit of carbon that you emit is a unit of warming. Not exactly, not like one-to-one mathematically, but and so it really matters what we do. Ideally, according to the IPCC worldwide, we're going to get to 50% emissions reductions by 2030. We need to act quickly if we want to avoid sort of the worst effects of climate change. I don't know what else to tell you. Like, that's just the reality of the situation. And what Enrique is seeing in Miami, that is going to continue. We're going to be able to adapt to that in certain levels. There are infrastructure things that we can change, but there's a certain amount of sea level rise. There's a certain amount of flooding. There's a certain amount of severe weather that we've already baked into the system because of our inaction.
So, Gina McCarthy, we need to act quickly, seems to be the message there. Is there enough time to do that?
Sure there is. I mean, it doesn't mean we're going to be able to reverse the damages that have already been done, but we can build resilience and adapt to a changing world. But we have to face it. You know, one of the wake-up calls, I hope, of COVID-19 is to tell us that our world can change on a dime, and frankly, so can people's behavior. We have an opportunity right now to recognize that clean energy is the future. Investing in those jobs is the future. That is how we're going to maintain a strong economy, get a strong economy again and maintain it and become competitive. You know, I think that this administration has been extraordinarily short-sighted at not recognizing that COVID-19 is a public health problem. So is climate change. And people are going to demand more. We need a better future. We cannot simply replace what we had before and call it success. You know, if you look at it, we have other countries like China in particular, who is eating our lunch on some of these clean energy technologies that we now have to buy from them. They're the ones that are getting all of the clean cars, the electric vehicles, from General Motors and others that we should have been demanding here. We are missing manufacturing opportunities and job growth and cost opportunities, cost beneficial opportunities. And we have to put people back to work. You know, honestly, I have no problem with people challenging environmental rules to make sure that they're cost effective and they grow jobs, because I will guarantee you that they do both of those in spades compared to the fossil fuel industry, which is bringing us backwards.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. An important discussion. Gina McCarthy, president and CEO of the Natural Resources Defense Council and former administrator of the EPA. Gina McCarthy, thanks so much for taking time to join us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Georges Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association. Dr. Benjamin, many thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And Kendra Pierre Lewis, reporter for Gimlet Media and author of Greenwashed: Why We Can't Buy Our Way to a Green Planet. Thanks so much for coming in and helping us, sort of serving as a guide through this important and somewhat perplexing set of issues. Many thanks.
Thank you so much, Anthony.
This is On Point. And we're going to end today's show with the sound of hope in troubled times. The hope comes courtesy of the birds and Dave Petit. Dave is being treated for cancer, and his therapy includes regular morning walks around Fresh Pond Reservoir in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he's never alone.
Is that a northern mockingbird trying out his sequence of songs, along with dealing with the coronavirus? Last September, I was diagnosed with inoperable metastatic bile cancer, which kind of puts me in the high risk category of complications where I had to get exposed to this virus. Baltimore Oriole, female. There's the male. I had hair loss early on, and some of that hair is returning. The red-winged blackbird. Trying to find some sense of hopefulness during these times has been certainly important for me as I deal with the ravages of chemotherapy. Although at the moment it seems like it's having a positive impact. Oh, there's a gray catbird. Every cycle I go through, it gets harder and harder. And for me, what that looks like is very intense fatigue and an overall sense of kind of queasiness, and that can look to me at times like 4 out of 5 weeks I'm feeling pretty lousy. So it's important that I find ways to kind of interrupt that because it can make me feel discouraged and anxious. And for me, getting out and for a walk, seeing the birds, being reminded that there are bigger things going on than what I can see just before me, it disrupts that process a bit. And I always feel better. Yellow warbler? Yellow warblers have this distinctive call that sounds to me like, sweet, sweet, you're so sweet. A pair of orioles calling. And now, given the nature of the diagnosis I'm dealing with and this pandemic, I feel even more grateful that I was able to get out to see some of this stuff. Of course, these frogs singing. I was someone who lived north of Boston as a kid, and there was this little small tract of woods across the street from our house, and I loved to go out and just look at whatever was out there. And this passion was nurtured by my grandmother, who, when I was 10 or 11, gave me a Peterson's field guide of the birds. Carolina wren. A little tiny bird that can belt out a song you can hear a long way away. I see a couple of other people here out bird watching. The owl in the box today.
Oh, have you seen it there?
Up until 3 days ago, it was there every single day for about 2 weeks. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. What do you have over here?
Pine warbler.
Yeah, I heard it calling.
Yeah, he's right up in the pine tree there.
All right, well, have a nice day, everyone.
So far, every person I've seen this morning is wearing a mask, which makes me feel good and feel like my risk is lower here. I can relax a tiny bit. Robin. There's something about being out here early on a Monday morning where it's quiet and having watched the birds change as the season has unfolded kind of gives me a sort of a daily sense of hope. Reminds me that humans have dealt with epidemics and pandemics before and we'll figure this out somehow, some way. Oh, there goes a Baltimore Oriole. Flying by, beautiful orange and black bird.
A daily sense of hope thanks to the birds. Dave Petit is a Unitarian Universalist minister living in Cambridge, Mass. He says he's holding up okay and getting out to walk regularly. Our audio postcard was produced by Tim Skoke. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.